Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight for our discussion on the Greens and Labor. And our two speakers, Brad Orgel, makes a first appearance at the Sydney Institute on the occasion of the publication of his book, Why Labor Should Savour Its Greens, Rebuilding a Fractured Alliance. And we've asked Cassandra Wilkinson to comment on that. I'll introduce both of our speakers briefly, starting first with Brad Orgel, who has degrees in economics and arts and environmental science and law. He worked for the global financial services firm UBS for over 20 years, including stints as CEO or country head in Hong Kong, Singapore and Australia. He's director of the National Broadband Network, chaired the task force that reviewed the federal government's Building the Education Revolution program, and is on the advisory panel for the Regional Development Australia Fund, and represents the Commonwealth on the Queensland Government's Post-Floods Reconstruction Authority. Cassandra Wilkinson makes a welcome return to the Institute. She's spoken here twice before. She's a columnist, a broadcaster. She's the author of Don't Panic, for which she spoke for the Sydney Institute some years ago. She's the co-founder and chair of FBI Radio 94.5 on FM, which is devoted to Australian music and is essentially a self-financing organisation. And she's going to comment on Brad's work. And the general topic tonight is the Greens and Labor, allies or enemies. Brad Orgel, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Jared, Anne, and the Sydney Institute for giving me this platform, and thank you for allowing me to introduce my book. A little over 12 months ago, the ALP embarked on an electoral strategy of differentiation, which included attacking the Greens and labelling them as extremist. And it was really that attack that catalysed me to do this book. I thought, as a businessman, as someone who's looked at the three platforms, the Coalition, Labor and the Greens, and found a lot of affinity with the Greens, I thought there was some responsibility for me to try and put my views out there in response to that claim that they were extremist. As many of you will know, the relationship has continued to deteriorate between the ALP and the Greens, and the Greens actually publicly chastised the ALP earlier this year, saying that the term and spirit of the 2010 federal governing agreement had been breached. And so now we've got the situation where many in the Greens want nothing to do with the ALP, and clearly vice versa. And I think, as someone who's interested in progressive politics, that these positions are short-sighted and really detrimental to the cause of genuinely progressive politics. As I say, it's clear to me that the Greens platform is not extremist nor loopy, and that if examined with an open mind to policy rather than politics, and my book is all about policy, the platform would make sense to many Australians. It's also obvious to me that historic ALP values and the Greens platform are not very far apart, and I found it very interesting doing some research on Ben Chifley, and I came to the conclusion that there was just as much chance, if he was alive today, that he'd be a Greens member as he'd be an ALP member. I think the rise of the Greens also, and the fracturing of the relationship, is really an effective fourth split of the ALP. The ALP has had upheavals in 1916, 1931 and 1955, and some of you may remember or know that after 1955 split, they were out of office at federal level for some 17 years. That was especially damaging, and by some of my research has shown that by the mid-1960s, the ALP support base was narrow and especially limited in its appeal to younger voters, to women and to immigrants. Labor in the 60s was seen as the party of trade unions and the blue-collar worker, but out of touch with the changing society. I remember the excitement as a young 10, 11-year-old when Whitlam was campaigning with the It's Time campaign. That was my first introduction to politics, and as I say in the book, when I was that age, I was learning guitar, and my guitar teacher actually had to stop because he could have been called up to go to Vietnam. And I thought that was particularly unjust, and that introduced me to politics and started my interest. I think the rise of the Greens is really a reversal of the broadening of the party that happened when Whitlam got into the leadership position, and which was extended by Hawke. So I think the AOP had a pretty narrow base in the 60s. They broadened with Whitlam's leadership, and we're seeing the reversal of some of that with the Greens now having 9 to 14% of the vote, depending on the year. And I think that's a pity. My background, and it's important you understand it in terms of my writing of the book. First and foremost, I'm an equity analyst. I've worked in financial markets. I've led UBS, as Jared mentioned. But at my core, my skill is as an analyst, and that's how I approached the book. I looked at the policy positions from an analytical point of view. I particularly looked at it in terms of the big picture issues that I see as important in the world today, and that reflects my 11 years living in Asia and the last 5 or 8 years that I've had back in Australia. I think increasing income and wealth inequality is a huge issue. I think rising corporate power relative to the power of governments and state is a big issue. I think the perceptions and the reality of wasteful government spending is a big issue. I think the unprecedented growth of mining fossil fuels in conflict with climate change. I also think government and religious control of individual freedoms, particularly post-9/11, is a big issue. I think the illegality of warfare that we've seen in Iraq and the economic sanctions on Iran are important issues. And I think the role of the media changing as the fourth estate is an important issue. So those are the chapters that I've looked at in my book in constructing the analysis of the Greens platform. I should also say that I've had a particularly unique exposure, I think, to look at both the private sector. All my career was in banking and the private sector. And I've worked in taxation earlier before that. But then subsequently, I was invited by Julia Gillard to do the investigation of the Building the Education Revolution, or Schools Halls program. And post that, as Jared mentioned, I've come to serve on NBN and QRA. And that's given me some insight into government, which I think is relatively unique. As I looked at the policies and I examined my own thinking and analysed the issues, and I started a blog, and I was particularly front and centre in the 2010 election campaign, because that was when BER was at the forefront. I started to try and crystallise my own thinking, and as I went through, particularly in the environmental and social policies, I found that most of the Greens' issues and policy positions accorded with my own views, particularly on things like climate change. I went back and did a Masters of Environmental Science and Law, and I think climate change is real. On mining, sustainability, particularly on issues like euthanasia. You know, I think that the Greens' position on euthanasia is a fair position. On the right to affordable housing, I've been concerned since I came back to Australia at this gap that's widened between haves and have-nots, and particularly the access to affordable housing, which is now, I think, very limited. I believe in high-quality public education. I went to Mount Waverley High School, non-selective, regular school, and I got to the top of UBS. I think it would be very hard today in most high schools. I also believe in marriage equality, animal rights, and various other positions I found as I went through and looked at the Greens' policies that they accorded with my own views. And so then I went and analysed them. I would highlight that my book is not just opinion. There's a lot of data, a lot of analysis calling on the statistics that are out there, informed by my education in environmental science, but also using the direct observation I've had of the Netherlands, Scandinavia, Germany, and having lived in Singapore and Hong Kong. And I've spent a lot of time in the Netherlands as part of the last 20 years. To give you a flavour of how I've approached the analysis, within the big picture issue of inequality, 1% of Australians today have 20% of the national wealth. The top 20% have 60% of the national wealth. And I look in my book at the trends that are causing that, which is really globalisation, putting downward pressure on middle-class incomes, our taxation policy that favours people with capital over incomes, negative gearing, for example, I explore. I also think there's a big gap in the way we set interest rates, where we focus just on consumer price inflation rather than asset price inflation. And I think that favours those that have capital and can invest into property or the share markets. And I think, as I mentioned on public education, I think the education system is cementing privilege. I also detail in the book why I think extreme inequality diminishes economic growth. If you have large amounts of a nation's wealth tied up in relatively few people, less is available to be spent by the mass, and therefore I think it diminishes economic growth, and I think that's a feature in the recovery that we're not really seeing in the US at the moment. And I also think it undermines the reality of democracy. I also found it very interesting in doing research that Franklin D. Roosevelt, when he was president of the US in the 30s, he faced the Depression and then war. In the early 40s, he came out with the concept that there should be a second Bill of Rights, and that second Bill of Rights should enshrine people's necessity and the fact that they had a right to basic education, basic high-quality education, free and affordable housing, and some of the other things that I see now enshrined in the Greens platform. So it's not, a lot of these issues are not new or extremist. They've actually been advocated by people as eminent as FDR 50, 60 years ago. In my chapter, just to continue the touching on the flavour of the way I've looked at it, in the chapter on the rising corporate power and the state of union representation, I look at the implications for democracy and the balance of power between the state and big business. I find it really interesting that companies like, and not just to single them out, but just as an example, Coca-Cola, Amatil, addressing the recycling scheme in the Northern Territory and taking that on into the court, where's the balance of power between the state's ability and for citizens to decide what's right for the country versus the corporation's ability to take that to court and have it reversed because it's not in their business interest? So I explore that topic and a number of examples, and I find it fascinating that often people who are on the other side of those debates still want to live where I live in Byron Bay, which is the heartland of the Greens. So often people who are opposed to some of the environmental actions that I think they shouldn't be, when it comes to where they live, they want to live in Byron. I do think that I'm not anti-corporates. Obviously, I've been in banking. Obviously, my whole career has been in the private sector, and I do think that properly channeled and moderately regulated, corporations are super effective allocators of resources, and they make a major contribution to lifting living standards and delivering us products that we all need and want. I think the question, and the question I explore in my book, is just what's the right balance of regulation? And I think the evidence suggests that market capitalism does not really ensure that there's proper self-regulation of some of the industries and some of the corporations. And therefore, I think there is a fair bit of empirical evidence to suggest that the Greens' approach to regulating some industries is actually appropriate. I also think their stance on limiting corporate and union donations to political parties is exactly right. I think we need to get more power back to the people deciding elections rather than big business or unions in terms of their funding of elections. And I explore that issue. Now, the Greens' policies on natural resources are probably the most contentious area out there. And their policies are that the natural resource development must be aligned to principles of intergenerational equity, biodiversity conservation, respect for traditional owners, and they must consider climate change and the precautionary principle. Yes, they strongly would prohibit union uranium mining, no expansion of coal mining, and a moratorium on coal seam gas until the science has been proved up. I think that the nub of the issue on the Greens' approach to mining is, do you believe climate change or don't you? Because if you do believe it, I conclude that it's hard not to reach the conclusion that we have to be careful in digging up coal and continuing to emit high amounts of CO2. And so I explore that issue in the book. We are close to the highest emitter in the world. More generally, questions I explore, though, outside of that is the argument about how fast the mining development of our resources should be. These are finite resources. Should we actually be rushing development, or should we actually be ensuring that we've got the ability to dig up resource in the long term? And also, what's the best way to maximise the revenue? Is it actually appropriate to be selling as much as to the world as we can today, or will prices increase and therefore we should be planning for a longer term revenue stream? I also explore why are we really happy having 75% of our mining industry foreign-owned and not having a mining super tax. You know, it seems to me if we're to capture the benefits of resources that we own as a country, these are issues that are valid and appropriate in a political platform. I do dedicate a substantial section of my book to economics and government spending. I don't believe in high taxing, high paying. I actually think that we could save 10% of all levels of government spending. We spend more than $500 billion across council, state and federal levels. And just the way that I've seen government programs operate and the gap between business and government spending and the amount of things that money is spent on, I think if you went through and ran government, the business of day-to-day government, like a CEO runs Woolworths, you could strip 10% out. And I think that's a huge opportunity. I don't think that we have to just tax more to spend more. Some would say that's the third way. And that's really where I'm advocating that the ALP and the Greens should be directing their policies. I do think that both the ALP and Greens need to strengthen their economic credentials. I think the ALP's lost the credibility it had in the Hawke Keating era. And I think the Greens' challenge is to deepen their economic policies and understanding of global market capitalism and consistently demonstrate the practical attainability of their policies. And I come from the point of view of having been first and foremost an economist. But I do think a strong regulatory framework to protect the environment and a genuinely progressive social policy platform does not need to be a high-spending government. I make the argument in my book that in assessing the far right's blunt critique of the Greens, that we should treat with skepticism their economic rationalist arguments. I think it's neoliberal economic policies that delivered us the GFC and climate change, and I think it's the neoliberal austerity policies that are failing to deliver us coordinated global economic recovery. I lived through the Asian crisis. I saw the impact of unregulated capital flows into Asia and the misery that that caused when it burst, and I think the GFC is just an extension of that. And I think climate change is another failing of the markets. That's where my mindset and my analysis is coming from. In government, I think the ALP has drifted to the right, and in practical terms, it's hard for most voters to differentiate ALP versus coalition social and environmental policies. And in any event, I think most voters place more emphasis and more importance on the ability to manage the economy effectively. I think we have had a two- or three-track economy for much of the past 5 years, and that there's a lot of detail below just the GDP numbers that's been lost to some of the politicians. I think job security has been diminishing, and there's been a rising amount of underemployment. I think cost of living has clearly been increasing, and the cost of essentials have been increasing at an alarming rate, obviously electricity prices and other things. And I think it's unfortunate the government has appeared impotent, particularly when those things, as we saw in Australian Story last week, are often the result of poor regulation of players in the marketplace and allowing them very high regulated rates of return and encouragement to overspend. Clearly, many voters reminisce fondly upon the economic stewardship of Howard and Costello. I think in all likelihood the Coalition will win this election on perceptions of economic management. I think they'll probably be in for 6 years and could be there for a decade. And therefore, I think it's important in mounting an effective opposition in the years ahead that the ALP will need to unite all of those on the progressive side of politics. If the ALP do lose the election, I talk in my book that I think most likely is that Bill Shorten will lead Labor. Today he heads the Victorian Unity right-wing faction of the party. I find it really interesting that of that faction's 8 goals, which were publicly on their website, 7 are entirely consistent with the platform of the Greens, and the 8th merely speaks of the need to balance electoral realities with ideal policy positions. His young Labor Unity faction, so the young Labor faction of Victorian Unity, their goals are even closer to the Greens, publicly up on their website. They publicly call for dental care to be part of Medicare, which is a Green achievement. They call for legislation of same-sex marriage, decisive action on climate change, and a humane approach to those seeking asylum. I believe that if you put the Greens and that young Labor group in the same room, you couldn't tell them apart. So I think to argue that they're extremist, as the ALP has done in their electoral strategy, and try to differentiate the values of the ALP versus Greens so clearly is a mistake and not true. Finally, I do believe there's deep voter appeal to a genuine policy platform that offers a third way, being fiscally conservative and competent in the day-to-day business of government and reducing wasteful spending, together with genuinely progressive social liberalism and high environmental protection. I think Malcolm Turnbull's probably the most popular politician in Australia today because he is viewed both as authentic, generally telling us what he honestly thinks, but also because we perceive his views are essentially third way. And I think that that's a signal for the ALP. If the ALP wants to reverse its structural decline within the hearts and minds of Australian voters, putting the individual popularity of Kevin Rudd to one side, I think it needs, in my opinion, to chart that sort of course, and constructing a simple but durable alliance with the Greens should be part of that solution. Thank you very much.
So next up, Cassandra Wilkinson. Thank you.
Hello. Thank you all for coming out on a cold winter's night, mostly for Brad and his excellent book, but to whatever small extent I owe you a thank you, it's very heartfelt. I really enjoyed your book. If a party like the one that you describe is ever formed in this country, I might vote for it. I might vote for you. I particularly liked the line in your book, "The number one priority of Cabinet should be how do we deliver better value for money from this gargantuan enterprise." And I thought there's a great deal to enjoy in Brad's book, even if you don't think you're agreeing, which I certainly don't. And a lot to think about in it. I guess, though, in the interest of providing not a rebuttal, because I think it's a great and very thoughtful piece of work that you've done, but let's say an adjutant, just to help discussion along, I present a view, I guess, that there are no extreme parties in mainstream politics in Australia at the moment. So last year, the Labor Party got a few headlines saying the Greens are extremists, we don't want to do business with them anymore. At the moment, a number of people are saying we must band together on the left because Tony Abbott is an extremist and we can't allow an Abbott government and his extreme conservatism to take over the country. But I guess I'd like to challenge that idea and say that I actually don't think that there are any genuine conservatives in a way that we would have understood the term up until 20 years ago left in this race. And equally, sorry, I think it's my fear of heights that's put me slightly off this evening, but happily, the sun's gone down, so I can forget we're on the 61st floor after a moment. Equally, there aren't any real progressives in this race either, not in the sense that we used to think about progressives as being about the great spirit of human progress, the kind of progressivism that built railways across the desert, the sort of progressivism that dreamed of building a nation of 200 million people here and a capital to rival Chicago and Paris. And whenever I get despondent, I like to reread the debates that happened before they built Canberra and to think about the kinds of politicians who dreamed of a city to rival Chicago and Paris because that's the kind of country that we were going to build here. And I think surely at some point we'll restore that kind of imagination to politics. So basically we have three major parties at the moment, Labor, Liberal and Greens, who are all essentially social democrats. There's no party in Australia that fully supports a planned economy or fully supports a free market. All three are in favour of a mixed economy, a big role for the public sector, and ad hoc industry subsidies. They've all lined up for automotive subsidies over the last couple of weeks, national broadband network, and a whole range of other publicly subsidised infrastructure projects. None enthusiastically support the free movement of labour and capital, and are variously and all opposed to limits on immigration, foreign investment, property ownership by foreign nationals. None are proposing major changes to the taxation system. The Greens propose a top marginal rate of 50% for people who earn $1 million PAYE. The Libs are proposing a minor reduction on company tax, but there's no root and branch tax reform, which is a shame given Ken Henry left a rather nice blueprint sitting around somewhere in an office in Canberra recently. There's also no party genuinely proposing any changes to get the government out of private life, to challenge the growing public health agenda, restrictions on food consumption, alcohol consumption, recreational activities, and our private choices around risk in sport and play or risk in our business transactions. There's no large party promising any change to Medicare, which accounts for 40% of the Commonwealth government's expenditure. So that's nearly half of everything that the Commonwealth government does has been put to one side in this election and left away from any discussion about what any of the parties would do should they win. In fact, all of them are talking about expanding Medicare into dental care, introducing disability care, and all have signed up for the Gonski funding reforms and an increased role for government in aged care. So there aren't really any Liberal parties. There isn't really a Conservative Party. There isn't really a Labor Party, and not particularly an extreme Green Party, really, given the limits of their aspirations for stated policy changes. So what we have is what a wittier person than I recently called on Twitter, the narcissism of small differences. So we have small changes proposed to job seeker allowances, final mile changes to the NBN rollout. We've got small disputes over the value of parenting payments, but nobody seriously opposing paid parental leave, which didn't exist 5 years ago. We've got junk food policies being reported as if they're health policies, and constant daily coverage of a few desperate people in boats as if there weren't a 27% youth unemployment rate to be discussed. So when I'm in a good mood, I see the convergence of our political parties as being consistent with us being a genuinely cohesive nation of people. We're all basically a nation of people with shared values, so it's kind of appropriate that our parties don't have extreme differences on fundamental issues. But when I'm feeling a bit bleaker, I think there's an element of truth in this, but it's really at odds with the gut feel view people have that politics is out of touch with what's happening to real people, and with the pervasive view that there are real problems in cost of living and real problems in people's aspirations for continuing improvements in their quality of life. And I've started to think, I guess, that we're in not only a two-speed economy, but a two-speed political landscape. There are those for whom the basic economic problem has been solved. They live in homes in the inner city, they have jobs, they have good quality public hospitals and schools, and their Maslow's hierarchy needs for politics have essentially been met, and they're ready to crave something bigger, something more spiritual, something more like visionary leadership. At the other end are the people commuting for an hour into Sydney or Melbourne or Brisbane for jobs, people with disabilities who can't get services, people on the unemployment line, people who are making up the growing number of those waiting more than 48 hours to see a doctor, the people for whom the growing costs of basic services are more than they can afford to pay. They're the people who can't pay the rising price of inefficient monopoly rents in our electricity system or our transport system or parts of our telecommunication network to come. They're the people who can't pay for the desalinated water that we didn't need when that was built. And they're the people who can't pay the no longer voluntary parent contributions at public schools. These people have not run out of real things to worry about, and they have not got to a point where they want to talk about marriage equality around the kitchen table. So what they need is not so much the kind of visionary leadership that the media is craving and that many parts of the middle class political kind of opinion makers are craving, but they actually need government to do better at the daily business of running government services. Business as usual government is what's been left out of the policy positions of all of the major parties, and in fact most of the minor parties as well. So we've got a health budget that's grown in the last 10 years by the size of an entire additional state. The health budget, just the growth, not the total, has grown by about the amount of the entire Victorian budget. And yet, we have out-of-pocket expenses double those in Britain and France, for average families, and growing. We've got people who are being going to public emergency rooms because they can't afford GP co-payments. And not since back in 2006, when we briefly discussed the federal government taking over the health system, has there been any real discussion about the substitution and the problems structurally impacting the Medicare system and the split of responsibilities between the hospitals in the states and the GP payment system coming out of Canberra? In education, all three have promised billions in additional money, but no detail on methodology. So last week, New Zealand announced that it would no longer have the Reading Recovery Program because it doesn't teach kids to read. We've got similar programs here, which some of the education leadership are saying, we have to discuss this, we have to talk about whole language, about phonics, about recovery, about doing the evaluation work that will tell us how can you teach kids to read better. Because if we don't change those daily practices, spending more money on the wrong thing will only scale up bad practice. Spending a little more money on the right things will be absolutely transformative. But that second piece of work, not only how much more money, but what are you going to do with it, is the missing part of the equation from all three major parties and every other minor party as well. So while I'm sympathetic to the view that it would be really lovely to have passionate, values-based leadership in politics, And I'm sympathetic to progressive causes, and I've written a lot of column inches in favour of the carbon tax and arguing for gay marriage and writing in favour of being more generous towards asylum seekers. I'm also completely despondent that these issues are front and centre at a time when the unemployment rate is higher than it has been in 5 years, when youth unemployment is higher than it has been in 15 years, and when housing affordability within an hour of Sydney City has been absolutely decimated over the last 10 years. So, the first and foremost, I guess, employment is the fundamental condition of economic and social participation. When youth unemployment was 27% under Paul Keating, he was being eviscerated in the papers every day for it. And it was Labor's worst problem during those years because people realised that that was fundamental. We were condemning children to having no future. It's happening again now, and somehow we're content to have our front pages dominated by leaky boats instead of dealing with what's happening to our kids. So, I guess the second major question for me from a social equity perspective, and you mention it in your book and I think fantastic because not enough people are talking about this, is the unaffordability of housing. The cost of housing has risen twice as fast, literally, as the rising income. So the cost of housing in Australia has completely decimated all of the real increases in living standards that we've achieved through our difficult economic restructuring, through all the productivity measures, through all the good work done by both Labor and Liberal leadership over the last 25 years to raise Australian living standards. And that's been eaten away because we haven't managed to solve the challenge of getting housing affordable. And I don't mean social housing, I mean getting good prices in market housing. So NatSem says house prices are up by 147% while real incomes are up by 57%. And we've now got plenty of OECD material that says that Sydney has the second highest housing prices in the developed world. Yet none of the parties has a plan to deal with the planning laws, which cause the delays in the approvals that drive up the financing costs that lead to uncertainty, with the basics regulations and all of the aesthetic standards that are being put in place. If you look at developments like Carlton United Brewery, the first developer went broke, waiting for approvals, dealing with public backlash. Second developer puts on so much Trigen and it's got pot plants hanging down the side of every building over there, and it looks fantastic, it really does. But those are $800,000 two-bedroom apartments. And we're living in a city now that's got a planning system that delivers $800,000 two-bedroom apartments. If there isn't a greater challenge to securing improved living standards for average Australians at the moment, I simply can't name it. So I don't believe any party, Greens, Labor or Liberal, can claim to be a champion of equity on the left or opportunity on the right unless we can do the policy work and make the reform that allows average income earners to be able to afford a reasonable place to live within a reasonable distance of jobs and services. And I suggest that a genuinely progressive agenda would focus on these people in that second speed politics, the people who need us to do better on the boring, basic, everyday functions of government, reducing the cost of housing, bringing down the price of essential services, making sure that every barrier to employment is steadily eliminated. And I think it's easy, and I think a lot of Green politicians have shown that it's easy to give a big speech about equity and children and justice and the future and how mining taxes will pay for it all because isn't Gina Rinehart sitting on a great big pot of coal? But it's much harder to deal with what Sir Michael Barber once called the relentless pursuit of incremental change, which is the daily business of government, and that daily business, that grind of working out how to do better at your core responsibilities. And it's boring to fix the planning system. It's boring to review the Tax Act, but those are the things that make a more prosperous community. And I wish the gay marriage lobby well. I wish the environmental lobby well. But I think that politics in Australia at the moment has lost all sense of proportion, and that when we talk about the needy, we talk about social justice, and we talk about equity, these are terms that we used to associate with helping the poor and needy. And we've really become I think victims of a politics dominated by the middle class. It's no longer about left or right or conservative or progressive. We are in a political environment that is about average people versus a particular kind of enfranchised middle class voter. And I don't think, with respect, that any party has a solution to this at the moment, but solving it should be the core business of all three of them. Thank you.
Thanks, Cassandra. So we've both come up here. I think one stand on one side, one stand on the other side. Alva, Kate, can I remind you to speak into the microphone? We have a direction microphone here, so you've got to speak right into it. There are copies of, Janet Grant's got copies of Brad's book, Why Labour Should Savour Its Greens, and I'm sure he'd be happy to sign any later. And so we come to question and discussion. I'll just direct a question to Brad. You mentioned that you thought Ben Chifley might join the Greens. I always thought that the light on the hill to Ben Chifley was burning coal, and he certainly came from a kind of coal electorate. But on the issue of coal, because you mentioned it, Bob Brown wants the coal industry to fade out. Christine Milne's not far behind that. But there are two issues here, aren't there? I mean, as you know from your own economic background, coal brings in a lot of money through the taxation system. But secondly, if Australia did fade out coal, what would other countries do to us who expect that we will sell it to them at market prices? I mean, if you simply close down the coal industry, what are people who import Australian coal going to do? Are they going to accept that because we want to be nice to one another or something like that?
Thanks, Gerard. Well, on Ben Chifley, the reason why I think he'd be just as likely to be Greens is that he actually married in the church of his wife, not his own. He actually, so therefore his approach to religion and conformity, I think, was strong at that time. He was a passionate defender of those that were downtrodden and those that were at the marginal end of society. He looked at the banking system and how we actually captured the most value for all citizens. And so I think on the social equity things, on some of the things that Cassandra mentioned, which I totally agree with, I think there's a good chance that he would have been very sympathetic to the Greens' positions. And remember, at that time, we had a very small population base relative to the resources of the world. You know, we had something like 2 billion people. We've now got 7 going to 9.5. And it was clear that we had ample resources in the world to support the population at the time. So environmentalism was not the passionate cause. Worker protection was the cause. But you can't have an effective economy, you can't have an effective society if you're not dealing with some of the bigger picture issue about resource constraints and climate change, is my view. In terms of coal, I think that it is a difficult issue. In an ideal world, we'll be able to put climate change on one side and say, let's not worry about it. And that's how most people actually would like to deal with it. Coal is particularly detrimental to climate change because of the amount of carbon emissions per unit of energy that comes out of coal. And I think that we have no choice as a globe to try and accelerate our use of solar, our use of renewables, and our use of gas at the expense of coal. The Greens' policy is not to close down coal, but it is to stop continuing to expand our coal exports and for us to push that shift. And I think it's inconvenient. I wish it wasn't the case, but I think if you do believe in climate change, we really have no choice. And some say, well, we're only 1% of world emissions. Yes, that's true. But we're also about the 7th in economic power. We have a very privileged position with respect to the US, and we have a good position with respect to China. China has introduced a market pricing mechanism for CO2 in Shenzhen just recently. There is a trial system in California. We could use the leverage of having the carbon tax in situ and addressing a responsible long-term shift away from coal to put more and more leverage on China and the US to solve this. We're never going to get all the nations around the world to agree, but if we could get China and the US working together, we'd be able to solve the problem.
Do you want to answer that, or we just go to Lindsay? Can you move over? Both of you move over.
Question to Brad. Within the Australian Federation, Tasmania is the greenest state environmentally and the greenest state politically, with Greens, the members of the government, members of the cabinet. It also has the sickest economy by a long stretch. Is that your recommendation for the rest of the country, and why isn't it working in Tasmania?
Well, I think Tasmania's position's been like that for some time, and I don't think there's a cause and effect. And in fact, I just spent a week in Tasmania, and I think the way that they've preserved the country and the opportunity for that to be a tourist attraction for people to come generally from the US and Europe to Australia, we'll be blessed with that in the long term. I think it's irreplaceable, some of the wilderness areas we have down in Tasmania, and I just loved spending a week there. Plus, I think the quality of food and produce that will come out of Tasmania. But I don't think there's a cause and effect. I think whichever party was in power in Tasmania, they would be the poor cousin. I do think that, and this is not advocacy for NBN, which I happen to be on the board, but I do personally think that the tyranny of distance will be closed for us relative to the world and for Tasmania relative to the rest of Australia and the rest of the world by developments like NBN. But I think there's not a cause and effect of the Greens being in charge in Tasmania and where Tasmania is, given its challenges as a small island.
You only comment on unemployment in Tasmania?
No, I might make a cheeky comment that had they gone ahead with that hydroelectric plant back in 82, they probably could support a lot more growth in industry, which is really just to say I don't think, as the Prime Minister said recently, it doesn't explain everything. It doesn't explain nothing. I think there are trade-offs. And being able to acknowledge them honestly and deal with, shall we say, adaptation challenges from moving from a brown to a green economy is something we're going to have a lot more honest discussion about, because I think the era of believing that green jobs can replace brown jobs one for one, that ecotourism will replace forestry, I think that's been tried and failed, and we're going to have to work a lot harder to stimulate those replacement industries.
Robert.
Cassandra, perhaps going on from that, you mentioned unemployment generally. Australia's unemployment is 5.whatever it is now percent. The recent Treasury statement said it will go above that next year, but nevertheless, they're levels that the rich world, United States and Europe, could only look upon with envy. Some would classify what we're in now as full employment. It's obviously higher in Tasmania, but lower than the national average in Western Australia. So what's your source? I'm curious about your source that youth unemployment is now at 27% as it was back in Paul Keating's day.
Good source of it. It's been that figure's been quoted recently in the news several times. But what I would say, without haggling a specific number one way or the other, is that unemployment, as you say, is not evenly distributed. So what we have are communities where there are deep problems with industry policy didn't save the Illawarra or the Hunter from the massive problem of structural change economically. We have regions which have no viable economic base, and we have a whole lot of barriers to people moving from areas of low employment to high. Stamp duty, for instance, is a barrier to people moving homes to go where there are better jobs. And we have different levels of... If you look at the aggregate and you can say, sure, you know, when Kim Beazley said he was going to set a 5% unemployment target, everybody laughed and said, don't be ridiculous, nobody can ever meet that. But there's two answers to that. One is that there's a lot of commentary at the moment about the amount of under-participation and under-reporting and hidden unemployment in some of the welfare definitional changes. Plus, there is people who aren't claiming welfare, who are not in work, and they're not counted in those official figures, but they're out there too, and post-GFC there's still a lot of them around. And the impacts across different parts, like the regions, some of the communities that are transitioning from old manufacturing and automotive industries, and this is, I guess, what my problem at the moment is that taking comfort in aggregates like we're doing better than Spain, or, you know, the national average is better than it has been, those things they're allowing us to gloss over serious problems underneath, allowing us to gloss over the fact that a young person who wants to find a job is struggling to find one, and even if they do find one, they can't live within an hour's distance of that job because the housing is unaffordable, because the transport links aren't there. And a big part of why they're not there is because we have business regulation, transport projects prevented by planning legislation. All of this growth of regulation, which is, it's not strictly speaking a green thing, the growth of regulation. It's been Labor, Green and Liberal responding to a NIMBY agenda, an environmental lobby agenda, a planning industry lobbying agenda, all of which is called quality of life and community consultation, but it's just driving up the cost of everything so that not only is that unemployment out there, but given the rising cost of housing and the greater difficulty of getting economically engaged, I just think this is becoming, in the places where it matters, it's more acute than ever. And those aggregates allow politicians off the hook who should not be allowed off the hook.
Do you want to mention that or not?
I'll just add two things. In my book, I actually calculate what's the level of unemployment plus underemployment, and that's using ABS statistics, and this is almost a year ago. Underemployment was 12%, which means that people are getting fewer hours than they want, because we've actually put people a lot onto contracts and part-time arrangements, and their hours have gone down. And even at 12 months ago, the rate wasn't 5%, but on a weighted basis, unemployment and underemployment was 8%. And I think it's gone up since then. Anecdotally, the last couple of days, I was told of a friend of a friend who went for a job at Bunnings, $20 an hour, 1,200 applications. And I totally agree with Cassandra that I think it comes back to the price of land and the price of housing. I think that's why we actually need to have the wages we have and the whole competitiveness of society, as well as the social dimensions of allowing our land and housing prices to get to the point that we have, is problematic.
Now, we've got to move quickly. We've got to go 1, 2, 3. Okay. Down there. You've got to be brief. And 4, yep.
Brad, I think your insight that this is effectively another split in the Labor Party is really important, because its consequences are going to work out for quite some time in electoral terms. But I think it's rather wishful thinking to think that there might be some policy coming together on the part of the Greens and the Labor Party. I think Cass is right that there's a big vacuum in policy making now, and particularly when you see Federal Treasury that can't forecast revenue numbers and hasn't been able to do it for nearly a decade now. And there seems to be nobody in Parliament in a position to be able to help Treasury with that problem. But the real, I think the real politic answer of your analysis is that the Greens are rapidly going to become the party that is like the DLP. It's just dedicated to keeping Labor out of office. If it's a competition between Christine Milne and whoever's the leader of the Labor Party as to who's going to be the major party of the left, the opposition, the dominant opposition party...
Okay.
You see the point.
Well, just for those who are not following all this, I think the Democratic Labor Party gave their preferences to the Liberals. The Greens give their preferences to the Labor Party. This is not... Any rate, Brad?
I don't disagree with you, but what I would say is this. I interviewed Bob Brown in October 2011. I asked him, what will happen if the other parties adopt some of your more interesting policies and there's no place for the Greens, you become redundant? And his reaction was both credible and, I thought, very good, that it didn't matter as long as someone implemented the policies that he believed in from his position. And my book is all about policies. I'm less concerned whether it's Greens or Labor. I would just like to see us become generally progressive on social and environmental policy and save a lot more money on government spending.
OK, so we come here and then here, yeah?
Brad, I was reading in the Australian on the weekend an article on green and solar energy and wind farms. And they're finding in Europe that it isn't working, that the climate isn't hot enough in a cold period to keep solar going, and they're having to turn off power. Now, how does that fit with Greens?
I'm not sure of that Australian article. My view is that Germany is successful at decentralising their energy requirements and at transforming their system more to renewables, and particularly to solar and wind. And I've read books on that, and I think that the Australian tends to have a particular position on climate change, and that maybe it's influenced some of those articles. But I think that unless we make a commitment to the path of solar, and renewables and gas to replace coal, we're going to continue to see escalating temperatures and climate change, and I think that's a big problem.
I was actually going to mention that after all. It's worthwhile for everybody to read it.
Because the article in the Weekend Australian last Saturday which suggested that green energy wasn't working in Europe.
That's right, and that there's been a paradox. And I think that's only come recently. Because that question's already been asked, just a comment. You did say that our cost of living was going up, was escalating, but our standard, we're consuming such a broad range of services now that our standard of living is going up. And it may not, we are actually causing the cost of living.
Well, I don't...
Can I comment quickly on that?
Well, let's go with Brad first, then Cassandra. Yeah. Yes, quickly, Brad.
Well, I look at my dad. In 1972, income of about $10,000 and a house cost about three times income. Now it's about six times. So I think the cost of living mostly is driven by the enormous increase in the cost of land that then underpins all other costs in the economy, personally.
Cassandra.
So I guess my quick comment on that is our standard of living has been going up. The cost of living has been going down on every single measure except housing. And the problem is that the price of housing has been going up so fast that it's eroding the gains that we're making everywhere else. Like, we are richer, healthier, longer lived, more literate. We're up on every single measure. But as long as the price of housing grows twice as fast as our average income, housing is down there undermining all of our gains. And it hasn't killed them yet, but that's why we've got to do something.
That's true, but there was...
we've got to move. Yeah, we've got Chris, and then we've got Tom, and then over here.
How do you propose to generate power for baseload power when it's one grid now from Rockhampton right down to Tasmania and across to Adelaide? How do you, if you exclude coal?
I'm not excluding coal. I'm just saying that we need over time...
You're talking about excluding coal.
Well, the grid...
Power stations like Bayswater, Liddell, and there's... small stations in Queensland like that that run 24 hours a day. They can wind them up and down, but they run on coal.
The Greens' position, as I understand it, is not to expand the coal industry. And my belief, and the points I make in my book, is that we need to shift away from coal towards a mix of solar renewables and gas, and that we also need to look at measures that will reduce our demand for electricity. I think we're relatively inefficient in our approach to how we consume electricity, and that there's enormous amounts that we can save, but just by better insulation, better building standards, and our approach to the consumption of electricity. I don't think there's any easy solution, but I think if one does believe in climate change, we need to start that transition, and we need to encourage other countries to start that transition.
Tom.
Cassandra, your core concerns seem to be social justice. In the corporate world, shareholders are consulted on special issues. In the 15th century, the word parlamento was devised, and it meant a form of government where the citizens were consulted on a regular basis to inform their rulers. Do you think the misalignment is between your concern for social justice and the accountability of our parliamentary representatives, and do we need a different structure to hold them accountable? In other words, more regular referenda, perhaps.
Okay, do we need to change the parliamentary structure?
I ran an incredibly unsuccessful campaign for pre-selection last year, and one of my core platforms was around participatory budgeting and deliberative democracy. I'm 1,000% with you on, I believe, in restoring the subsidiarity principle in the Constitution, pushing all funding and decision-making down to the lowest possible level, to the level of the citizen, wherever you can. But I can't say that I found that a very popular view.
there's a question here. Yeah.
My question's Brad and Cassandra. One of the problems I perceive with the Greens is, even assuming everything you say tonight is correct about the rationality and good sense of their policies, when you've got the dominance in Australia of the News Limited papers in particular, who make no secret of their views about the Greens, dominating to such extent, and also not just News Corp, but also some of the free-to-air TV stations as well, in their news coverage, how do the Greens and, to some extent, the progressive element and the Labor Party get their message out to the voting public along the lines that you've been talking about tonight.
Through the ABC.
Some muttering to you through the ABC.
I think there's different answers to that, yeah.
Okay. Brad.
I was actually a media analyst in the 1980s, and so I covered News Corporation, met Rupert Murdoch as part of that process. I think he's a tremendous businessman. But I think as a country, we shouldn't allow the ownership of the Murdoch papers, when that ownership will ultimately change, to go in one block to someone else. I think we should look to a long-term plan to have less concentration in the industry. I think that's the long-term solution. But I'm also really encouraged by the rise of social media, and new startups like Huffington Post and The Guardian and other vehicles that may increase the opportunity for voice out there.
But if Murdoch's papers went up today, who would buy them?
I don't think we should allow someone to buy all of them.
But would anyone buy it?
Nobody would buy it.
We've just seen Amazon founder just buy the Washington Post. So, yes, I think there are billionaires out there that would buy. We shouldn't allow them to be sold in one block.
So, no. Cassandra, you want to make a
quick comment? I don't think the eccentric billionaire-led media recovery is necessarily a sustainable strategy for that. But just one little quick fact. Last week, online advertising overtook TV for the first time ever. So we are arguing over dinosaur media at the moment. People will communicate on different platforms and the newspapers won't matter that much anymore. The idea of a newspaper-led conspiracy to change politics won't last till the next election, I don't think.
Right, so we're pretty well coming to the end. We have one here, and have I missed someone? Okay, well, the last two. Have I missed anyone? Okay, one. And, oh, Craig, one, two, three. Got to be very quick.
Yep,
very quick.
How are we going to employ those people who are in the, for instance, the motor industry and the associated parts suppliers to the Ford company? How are we going to employ that kind of, that level of person in the future?
I love this question.
Briefly.
Please, government, stop paying for cars and start paying for public buses. Every capital city has a massive public transport problem. Every capital city in this country has got billions a year to spend on buses and trains, which are largely built here and are always maintained and repaired and serviced here. All of those people could be re-employed on genuinely necessary activities and economically productive work.
This question here, and then we'll end with Craig.
Yep. I just got some input on the Weekend Australia article that's mentioned. And
well, go be brief.
Okay. I think that what's going to happen is storage technologies are going to come on fast, and we need to be building an infrastructure now that's going to be able to put some energy into those storage technologies.
For solar.
That will give us base load power. Whether it's solar or wind, I think things like Adelaide have been tremendously successful. We've got over 70% some nights in Adelaide fueled by wind power. And I think what's happened in Germany is, in fact, it's economically may look bad, and that's because they phased out their nuclear power after Fukushima.
I think there's a call for more nuclear power here. Isn't there? Do you want to? The Greens got a policy on nuclear power? Right?
The Greens are opposed to nuclear power.
And coal, yeah. Craig, last question.
Brad, you talked about economic credibility and the lack of it on the left of politics. What do you think it's going to take to actually make a change to that? Is this the beginning of your political career? Because I think whether it's perception or reality, the public do think that it's a whole lot of ideology, and you've got to be able to deliver it. So what do you see evolving to get that credibility? Because the whole debate today in the election is about economic credibility.
Yeah, I don't think, it's not the start of my political career, but what I do think, and I used to sit on the BCA, the Business Council of Australia, and I've had a fair bit of interaction with various heads of public service departments, if we could just bring those people together, if we could intern senior people in public service for periods of a year, say, in the BCA companies and take some of those executives into the public service, we can't continue to operate a country where we've got a political class that's increasingly incestuous. You know, they never work before they go into politics. And we've got the public service, great people, but a big distance between them and the politicians and business. You know, we've actually got to get business involved, and I think there's a big role for the BCA.
Going back to your book, have you sent a copy to Senator Milne, have you sent a copy to Bob Brown, and has it had a rave review yet in Green Left Weekly?
Actually, I don't find a lot of supporters for my book because Labor doesn't want to hear about the Greens, and the Greens don't want to hear about Labor, so, you know, but I wanted to put my analysis out there, so no vote reviews.
But what about Christine Milne going to get a copy?
Oh, they all have copies, and I've spoken to them plus other people.
All right. Well, many thanks for tonight. I should have said thanks to King and Wood Mellison for use of this facility tonight. Congratulations to Brad on his very thoughtful book, Why Labor Should Savour Its Greens, and as I said, there are copies for sale down the back. Thanks for a fine presentation tonight, and thanks for Cassandra Wilkinson for a lively commentary. So it's been a good discussion, a thoughtful discussion, and it'll be recorded permanently on our various outlets here at the Sydney Institute. So well done, Brad, and thank congratulations, you. And thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.